Tantor Audio presents The Luckiest Lady in London by Sherry Thomas, narrated by Corey James. Prologue. For as far as he could trace back in time, Felix Rivendale had spent half an hour each day with his parents before tea time, and as far as hazy childhood memories could be trusted, he had always looked forward to and feared that time equally. Every afternoon, his governess brought him to the door of the parlour. He'd scratch timidly at the heavy oak panel and be told to enter. His beautiful mother, seated in her favourite chair, would put aside her embroidery, rise and open her arms to welcome him. He always crossed the room as fast as his legs could carry him and always stopped just short of the huge perimeter of her skirts. It wouldn't do to run smack into Mother. Her hoops would fly up behind her, he had been told, and that would be a very awful thing to happen. Felix was careful. He didn't want anything awful to happen. Gingerly, then, he navigated his way around the tricky skirts and up the chair. This was his favourite part of the day, to be ensconced beside his mother and enveloped in her heavenly scent. She'd ruffle his hair and kiss his cheek and call him, to his delighted embarrassment, Muffin Cake. Immediately, however, came his least favourite part. His father, who had been observing them keenly, would storm to a far window and stand with his back to the room. His mother, so affectionate until that moment, would smile an odd, rather chilling smile, cease all her petting, and return to her needlework. Felix was allowed to watch her quietly, which he did, a little miserably, constantly aware of his father's turned back. By his fifth birthday, he had decided that there was something wrong with him. He must be the cause of all the tension, which became more palpable, more breath-crushing, when his parents were forced into close proximity with him. The daily half-hour before tea was bad enough, but Sunday mornings, with all three of them sitting side by side in the front pew of the parish church, while the sermon droned on and on, were pure torture. Their desire to get away from him was a palpable weight upon his chest. Every breath felt like inhaling needles. At six, he came to a shattering conclusion. His parents hated each other. But after two more years of stealthy yet intense observation, he revised his previous verdict. It wasn't quite true that his parents despised each other. His mother could not stand her husband, but the latter didn't find her as loathsome as she did him. In fact, the Marquis was always the one who started conversations, which were usually cut short by the Marchioness's chilly replies that barely fell short of discourtesy. He also brought her gifts, which she tossed into the bottom of her trunk without opening. Felix knew because he liked to sit in her rooms and touch her things when she was out of the house for her daily drive, imagining that she was sharing her time with him, imagining that the scent of her came not from lingering molecules of perfume in the air, but from the very fabric and folds of her gown as she let him snuggle next to her. One afternoon, not long after he turned eight, he found a new packet in the trunk, a large, square, black velvet box. Inside, nestled against cream satin, a magnificent necklace of rubies sparkled like crystalline drops of blood. He set the necklace next to the long strands of black pearls, the diamond earrings, the many rings and bracelets and brooches and jewelled hair combs. Beautiful, exquisite things, each and every one. Why wouldn't his mother forgive his father? Once, below stairs, Felix had seen a footman give a chambermaid a small ring, saying that it wasn't real gold, only made to look so, but he hoped to be able to afford a better one in the future. The maid had jumped into his arms and kissed him with great abandon. Not even real gold! And the girl had been in seventh heaven. Why didn't his father's gifts please his mother in the same way? he decided to find out from the Marchioness's maid. The story she told flabbergasted him. Once upon a time, 10 years ago to be exact, Mary Hamilton had been the most beautiful debutante in London. She had many admirers, Gilbert Rivendale, the Marquess of Renworth, among them. But she preferred another gentleman who, unfortunately, had not a sou to his name. The Marquess proposed and was politely turned down. Undaunted, he went to Sir Nigel, Mary's father, and offered him an astonishing sum for his daughter's hand. Sir Nigel had a weakness for the gambling table. His gaming debts had pushed him to the brink of bankruptcy. The Marquess's offer was readily seized upon. Sir Nigel commanded Mary to marry according to his wishes. When she refused, she was locked in her room with no means of reaching her beloved. She capitulated after 4 months of house arrest, living on only water and bread. 2 months later, she became the Marchioness of Renworth. The marriage, however, was doomed from the start. She abhorred the Marquess passionately for his part in derailing her dreams. Since her father died not long after the wedding, she decided to dedicate the remainder of her days to making her husband forever rue the day he laid eyes on her. The Marquess was first given to believe that he had finally attained the sweet wife of his dreams. Then, bit by bit, she began to chip away at the happiness she had bestowed upon him, until, in a great strategic blow, she let slip that Felix might not be his. Felix did not run from the room, but it was only because he had become incapable of all movement. Jess Jenkins, the maid, had related the story as she cleaned the Marchioness's combs and brushes. When she was finished, she said, "Don't feel so bad about it, young master," and left to join the other upper servants for their own tea, served in the housekeeper's parlour. Felix, on the other hand, did not eat for the rest of the day. That night he woke up from a nightmare. In his dream, he was being sent away from home. He couldn't sleep again, even after he had made his way to the kitchen and wolfed down 2 stale scones for his gnawing tummy. The next day his nightmare was confirmed. His father spoke of sending him to a preparatory school now that he was fully 8 years of age. Felix's stomach roiled with fear. He kept beseeching his mother with his eyes. She said nothing. He lived in a state of terror for the next month, checking his wardrobe 2x a day to make sure his things hadn't been packed yet. But nothing happened. No more was ever said of boarding schools. His tutor, Mr. Lehigh, showed few signs of imminent departure. And at last Jess Jenkins told him that his mother had refused to let him go. He was incoherent with relief and gratitude. The bad dreams, however, did not cease. He awoke always around 11:30 and could not go back to sleep before 3. So instead of tossing and turning in his bed, after his midnight snack, he took to walking the grounds of Huntington and looking at the stars. Soon he was learning the constellations with the help of Mr. Lehigh's books. There was something marvellously soothing about the movement of the stars, progressing through the firmament solemnly and predictably with the march of the seasons, unaffected by the human tumults that had Felix in their relentless grip. The domestic situation deteriorated slowly and steadily. The years did little to mellow the Marchioness's icy rage. The Marquess plunged into ever deeper despair. Felix tried to placate both of his parents. He gave presents, bouquets of wildflowers for his mother, rocks bearing fossilized leaf prints for his father. The Marquess barely glanced at his gifts. The Marchioness cooed over the bouquets and Felix himself. And then the tension between all three would turn more poisonous than ever. Gilbert Rivendale was squatly built, with pale hair, pale eyes, and indistinct, forgettable features. Felix, on the other hand, was often praised as an uncommonly beautiful child, his mother's spitting image. Dark hair and deep green eyes, tall and slender of build. Felix desperately wished he had something of his father, be it the bulbous nose, the weak chin, or the scant eyebrows, so that the poor man wouldn't search his face day in and day out, looking for some proof that Felix was a product of his loins. The Marquis would be plagued by doubts to the end of his days. But Felix became convinced of his paternity. In the Marquis's absence, Felix never got so much as a nod from his mother. The displays of affection and indulgence were only that, displays, intended to fire jealousy and discontent in the Marquis, to make him think that a man she liked better had fathered the boy. Felix hated her heartlessness, that she regarded her only child as but a pawn, and used him with no concern for his welfare. He hated his father's gross stupidity, that he could not understand that it was a game, and that she would never have dared drive a wedge between father and son had Felix actually been the result of adultery. When he reached 13, he couldn't wait to be sent away to a public school, to god-awful food and drafty residence houses where boys beat one another and were flogged in turn. Anywhere to be away from home, away from his mother's machinations and his father's unmanly wretchedness. But somehow she prevented that too. She wanted him around to plague her husband. Two more tutors were hired, and at home Felix was stuck. So he learned to play the game. He began to make demands, always at their gathering before tea time, to his mother's beaming countenance as she looked upon her husband's spawn with counterfeit tenderness. He asked sweetly for the best portable telescope yet built, for subscriptions to scientific journals, for classics on astronomy, and for exorbitant increases in his quarterly allowance to purchase whatever else he wanted. He spun tales to undermine her smugness in her power. "I'm so sorry, mother," he'd say innocently, when they were thrown together accidentally alone. "Why?" she'd ask. "Oh, you didn't know, nothing then," he'd exclaim, pretending to be distraught. But then, under her persistent probing, he'd let slip that he had heard that father had set up a young mistress in town and was quite wild about her. He milked the phantom mistress for nearly 2 years, watching with cynical amusement his mother's fruitless search for the shameless tart, who dared to ensnare the husband for whom she had no love and even less use. She realized at last it was a hoax, and that her son had become at age 15 a formidable player on his own. The last pretenses of maternal affection promptly disappeared. And yet, her unexpected death 2 years later devastated him. They had been engaged in a war of attrition, but he came to understand, as he sat by her lifeless body, his eyes burning with unshed tears, that for him at least, the struggle for the upper hand had been only a front. He had never stopped trying to gain her love, or at least her admiration. All along, he had been trying to show her that they were so much alike they could be great friends and allies, if only she would let it happen. To his shock, when his father died within months, he was no less shattered for the obtuse, ungainly man who paid for his one great error with almost 2 decades of suffering, and who, according to the family physician, passed away of a broken heart. And he realized at last, as he watched the late Marquis's casket being lowered to the ground, that though father and son had looked nothing alike on the surface, underneath they had yearned for love with the same intensity, the same stubborn hope that even years of antipathy could not completely erase. Felix would recast his entire life. At 17 he had become a peer of the realm, one of the richest at that. But just as important, the isolation of his early years afforded him a blank slate on which to create a whole new persona for himself. It did not take him long to decide that, of course, he was his mother's son. The late Marchioness of Renworth, despite her insidious domestic tyranny, had maintained an unblemished reputation as a perfect lady, a shining example of all that was good and pure in a woman. He planned to eclipse her in both acclaim and influence, a fitting tribute from the son for whom she had so little regard. As for his father, Felix's tribute to him would be to never repeat the man's great mistake of loving with all his heart and soul. Friendship he would permit, and perhaps some mild affections. Love, however, was out of the question. Love made one powerless, and he had had enough powerlessness to last 10 lifetimes. In this new life of his, he would always hold all the power. And he succeeded remarkably. He was extremely popular with his classmates at Cambridge, where he read mathematics and physics. He conquered London society with equal aplomb, and became in no time one of the country's most eligible bachelors. In the beginning, he worried that he'd meet a girl who would enslave him. But seasons passed, ladies he met by the gross, and not a single one caused the slightest ripple in his heart. It was as if his capacity to love had been buried 6 feet under, alongside his parents. Once in a blue moon, when he was alone at night with the stars, he missed it. The ability to feel, and feel deeply. But the rest of the time he was all too glad to be in absolute control over every aspect of his life, particularly his heart. In 1885, when he turned 25, he let out the word that he was ready to settle down with the right girl. The matrons heaved a collective sigh of relief. How wonderful! The boy actually understood his duties to God and country. He had no intention of marrying, of course, until he was at least 45. A society that so worshipped the infernal institution of marriage deserved to be misled. Let them try to matchmake. He did say the right girl, didn't he? The right girl wouldn't come along for 20 years, and she'd be a naive, plump-chested chit of 17 who worshipped the ground on which he trod. Little could he guess that at 28 he would marry, out of the blue, a lady who was quite some years removed from 17, neither naive nor plump-chested, and who examined the ground on which he trod with a most suspicious eye, seeing villainy in everything he said and did. Her name was Louisa Cantwell, and she would be his undoing. Chapter 1. Lord Renworth might not have heard of Louisa Cantwell until the spring of 1888, but ever since 1883, years before he'd declared his hand available, his name had sat atop her list of eligible young men. But while Louisa maintained and frequently revised her list of the rich bachelors of the realm, she rarely thought of the almost mythical Lord Renworth. He was an abstract concept, too lofty and perfect to figure into the calculations of a pragmatic girl under no illusion that she was good enough for the ideal gentleman. To begin with, the Cantwells were poor. Louisa, her four sisters, and her mother subsisted on an annuity that had been settled on Mrs. Cantwell long ago. Once Mrs. Cantwell drew her last breath, the Cantwell girls would have little more than the clothes on their backs. In addition, the family was somewhat scandalous due to the late Mr. Cantwell having once been a fortune hunter. He was not particularly evil. When he realized that his pretty new wife was nowhere near as wealthy as he had thought, he shrugged and made peace with his failure. But Mrs. Cantwell was not received by her family and old friends as long as her husband lived. And while her daughters were respectable, their respectability was as threadbare as some of Louisa's petticoats. And even if a prospective bridegroom could overlook both Louisa's empty purse and her dubious parentage, he must still deal with the fact that she was something of a bumpkin. She could not paint, play the pianoforte, or speak a foreign language. She had only the faintest grasp of art, history, and literature. and of her penmanship, the less said the better. Her lack of fortune, pedigree, and accomplishments did not particularly bother Louisa. She was, however, greatly frustrated by the fact that for someone who needed to marry a great deal of money, she was not a singular beauty, as great a handicap as setting out on safari without a working firearm. Her two elder sisters were both exquisite, but Frederica had not left her room since becoming mildly pockmarked after a bout of smallpox, and Cecilia was determined to kiss only her best friend, Miss Emily Milton. Of her two younger sisters, Julia was of completely the wrong temperament for the wooing of gentlemen, and Matilda, dear, dear Matilda, was an epileptic, and therefore out of the question. All the other Cantwell sisters were able-bodied, capable of working as governesses or ladies' companions to support themselves. Even Frederica, Louisa was sure, would abandon her reclusive ways if she were actually starving. But Matilda must be looked after at all times. She needed a man of means. Since Matilda could not handle the rigours of a London season herself, Louisa had to be the one to try. On the day Louisa realised this, when she was 16, she walked 3 miles from her house so she could despair without anyone seeing her. She gave herself 1 hour. Then she returned home, opened her notebook, and turned to the last page. Everything I want. A small cottage. Books as many as said cottage can hold. A good telescope. Miss Ye's catalogue. A tutor in higher mathematics. When it had seemed that both Frederica and Cecilia might make brilliant matches, Louisa had dreamed of being a happily independent spinster. But dreams were for girls who could afford them, and she was no longer one of them. She crossed out the list and started a new one. Everything I need to win a man with £5,000 a year. Louisa would have liked to win that rich man when she was 19. Lady Balfour, Mrs. Cantwell's cousin, had promised to sponsor one of Mrs. Cantwell's daughters to a season. But first Lady Balfour had to marry her own daughters. Then she had to refrain from going out in public during her mourning period for Sir Augustus, her husband. When Louisa finally arrived in London in the spring of 1888, this was how the list looked. Everything I need to win a man with £5,000-£7,000 a year. Being impecunious herself, Louisa had quite underestimated the kind of expenses a man with a large income would have, as well as the number of relations who depended on his largesse. Bust improvers. Recipes for shiny hair, bright teeth and soft skin. An understanding of fashion, fabrics and the styles and cuts of garments that best flatter figure. Familiarity with French, as commonly seen on menus. The ability to dance passably well. Deftness at flattering a gentleman. Deftness at flattering said gentleman's mother and sisters. The understanding that no matter how much interest a man professes in a young lady, he is still more interested in himself. The understanding that if a young lady is seen to be having a good time, she is much less likely to be thought of as scheming. A coherent strategy before the beginning of the season, and tactics in place before each engagement. Time is limited. Preparation is critical. The understanding that, God help me, I must not fail. By the time Louisa walked down the grand staircase at her first ball, she was 24, well past the first bloom of youth. But all her extra years of practice, she didn't simply make a list and consider her task done, had paid off, and London was quite taken with her. Or rather, with the Miss Cantwell she presented to society. She was warm, but not over familiar, sweet, but not cloying, and appreciative of her moment in the sun without the least whiff of graspingness, or worse, desperation. Best of all, Miss Cantwell, it was generally agreed, was a beauty. For a beauty, one hauled out a different set of adjectives. Her neck was praised as sylphish or swan-like. Her eyes, hitherto simply blue, were now either azure or aquamarine, and sometimes nothing less than cerulean. and apparently no one in London had ever heard of that decent, hard-working word, brown. Her admirers insisted her hair was mahogany, chestnut, or any other arboreal hues that struck their fancy. A few, bent on ever more poetic rubbish, called it Titian or coppery, preferring to give emphasis to the flecks of reddish gold embedded therein. All this linguistic extravagance sometimes made Louisa laugh at night under her blanket, and it sometimes made her quake, for surely the illusion couldn't last the entire season. Soon people would realize that her hair was glossy, only because of all the mayonnaise she'd put in it over the years, that her trademark close-mouthed smile was to hide several crooked teeth, and that, of course, the bodices of her dresses would look awfully concave if it weren't for the artful and stalwart bust improvers in her wardrobe. But all in all, things were going very well for this early in the season. Gentlemen flocked to her as attentive and eligible a group as she had hoped for in her most ambitious dreams. Perhaps too much so. Among them were a number who paid court to popular girls by habit. A few were in her vicinity simply because it was where their friends gathered. This crowding of the field worried her, as the two gentlemen she most wished to encourage were not forward enough to compete with the more exuberant swains who did not interest her, and she dared not be any more obvious in her encouragement when surrounded thus. Viscount Firth and Mr. William Pitt, the latter heir to Baron Sunderley, were her choices. Both were prosperous, kind, solid country gentlemen. Both were earnestly looking to settle down. Lord Firth was in his mid-thirties, more rugged than handsome, but not displeasing to view. He was by all accounts an excellent fellow, if rather straight-laced in his views. But he seemed to be of the nature to be open to a woman's persuasion, provided he believed that the woman essentially agreed with him. Mr. Pitt, bespectacled and a bit rotund, was an even greater favourite with Louisa. In him she sensed a much more malleable nature. His income would be less than Lord Firth's, but in the end what mattered most was not the gross amount, but the percentage she could command. Mr. Pitt would make a supremely acceptable spouse, Louisa was certain. Unfortunately, he happened to be a most awkward suitor. He didn't dance, lacked a commanding presence, and was minimally accomplished at the art of small talk, which relegated him to the periphery of her circle, a place he uncomfortably yet obdurately occupied. Her heart rather went out to him. There was much she could do to help him better negotiate a crowd if she were his wife. Or once they married, they could settle in the country and he wouldn't have to socialize at all if he didn't wish to. But before any of those ameliorations could take place, she must become his wife. So toward that noble goal, she redoubled her effort on the night of Lady Saverin's ball. "Will we have a wet summer? What do you think, gentlemen?" she asked, as thunder boomed audibly in the distance. "That won't be fair," a young fop protested. "Rain, if it must come, might as well come in winter, when it's miserable anyway. The English summer is short enough as it is." "Right-ho," his friend seconded. "A crying shame." "What do you think, Mr. Pitt?" Louisa reached out to her quarry. "I understand that you take a keen interest in meteorology. Have you observed any signs of soggy months to come?" Mr. Pitt cleared his throat with flustered happiness. "As a matter of fact, I have. I have been going over some records. The current atmospheric conditions, I believe, combined with—"
"What is this? A session at the Royal Society? Did I stumble upon the wrong gathering? But lo and behold, Miss Cantwell, it is you. Why do you let fellows bore you with such trivia? Who gives a tuppence for atmospheric conditions?"
Mr. Pitt shrank promptly before this onslaught of delighted ignorance. Louisa groaned inwardly. But it wouldn't do to openly offend Mr. Drummond. He was, incomprehensibly enough, one of the so-called arbiters of society, presumably because everyone cringed to be on the receiving end of his ostentatious rudeness. "Mr. Drummond," she acknowledged him with unexceptional cordiality, We are having a discussion on the weather, and Mr. Pitt was just about to give us some very informative—" If she had hoped to subtly chastise him, she failed utterly, for he interrupted her too.
"I say, why talk if you can't do anything about it?"
Poor Mr. Pitt was now flame red. Louisa gritted her teeth. Mr. Drummond didn't so much court her as he displayed before her his skills at the game of courtship, and to everyone's detriment he was of the belief that to make himself appear superior, others must suffer in comparison.
"Well, I for one do believe there is intrinsic value to the study of meteorology," said an unfamiliar voice somewhere to Louisa's right. Interestingly, Mr. Drummond, instead of dispensing with yet another of his acerbic remarks, accepted this rebuff without any protestation.
"Oh, if you say so, Wren."
Wren? Could it be? Mr. Pitt exhaled with relief.
"Thank you, my Lord Renworth."
The ideal gentleman, in the flesh. To say that he would make an excellent husband for Louisa was analogous to declaring that a thoroughbred stallion qualified as a four-legged beast of burden. His income was in excess of £200,000 a year. In addition to that staggering wealth, he possessed good looks, charisma, athleticism, and tact. Not to mention that his character was so far above reproach that reproach would need a telescope to observe his universally lauded conduct. Prince Charming, absolutely. The Holy Grail, almost. Louisa had not been in a particular hurry to meet the Marquis. A sensible woman, who could afford only a gig, did not spend her days dreaming of barouches. But now that Lord Renworth was in her vicinity, she was not going to pass on a detailed survey of this paragon of masculine virtues. She would, however, be discreet about it. Lowering her eyes, she started from his shoes. They had seen at least two seasons, possibly three, yet they did not appear worn, only comfortable. The leather shined and buffed to a high sheen was as supple and luxurious as a courtesan's caress. In contrast, Mr. Pitt's spanking new evening pumps looked as if they pinched his toes and chafed the backs of his ankles. Her gaze travelled up Lord Renworth's expertly pressed trousers to the flute of champagne at his side, dangling from his fingers. Many of the guests at the ball had such crystalware in their hands. Lady Tenwessel, for one, held hers decorously before her person. Mr. Drummond, for another, idly turned his round and round. Lord Renworth's champagne glass, however, gave the impression that it had leaped off a table of its own will into his hand, because it would never fit better elsewhere, or emanate a quarter so much ease and aplomb. On that same hand he wore a signet ring, a coat of arms engraved upon a crest of deep, rich carnelian. The white cuff of his shirt extended a perfect quarter inch beyond the dark sleeve of his evening jacket. The cufflinks were simple gold studs, or perhaps not so simple studs, for she could see lines and patterns, too fine for her to make out the design from where she stood. She was stalling, she realized, lingering in the same spot because she was not afraid exactly, but rather apprehensive about looking higher. But really, what could he possibly do to a woman as practical as herself? Her soul was devoid of romantic yearnings. If she didn't need a husband, she would have happily embraced spinsterhood. All at once she lifted her gaze. She might as well get it over with. She was presented with a head of thick black hair and an aristocratic profile. Then, as if sensing her attention, he turned to her. A pox on everyone who had ever told her that the ideal gentleman was handsome. He was not handsome. He was extravagantly gorgeous. One look into his serene yet hypnotic green eyes, and all the romantic yearning she had never before experienced struck her at once, like a bullet to the heart.
"Miss Cantwell," said Mr. Drummond, "allow me to present my esteemed friend, the Marquis of Renworth."
Lord Renworth bowed slightly, his motion fluid, his manners commendable, an open amiability with no arrogance or condescension.
Enchanted, Miss Cantwell.
The not-quite-smile of his lips threatened to turn her into a gelatinous mass, like a clump of beached sea nettles. How could she defend against such perfection? How could anyone defend against such perfection?
She must. She had a task here in London. She could not trail Lord Renworth all about town in the wretched hope that he would notice her. She had no doubt he would.
Perceptive man that he must be, and he would treat her lunacy with great kindness, sparing her any embarrassment, if at all he could, while gently steering her toward less unobtainable gentlemen, thoughtfully reminding her that much depended upon a judicious marriage on her part. But how could she continue? She was only mildly fraudulent, not profligately so. She could not pursue Lord Firth or Mr. Pitt, while her heart burned for someone else, while she compared them to the peerless Lord Renworth, and found them woefully inadequate at every turn.
"My Lord Renworth," she croaked, sinking into a curtsy.
As she straightened, their eyes met again. She managed a few meaningless words of small talk.
"Yes, I am enjoying my first season. Alas, my family cannot be here with me. No, I do not find London's air more noxious than I have been told to expect."
Heroically holding herself upright, while her spine liquefied, vertebra by vertebra. It was difficult to draw breath. Her heart palpitated in both pleasure and panic, and she flushed furiously, too much heat pulsing through her veins for her to control or disguise. A heartbeat later, however, she was cold. She could not say how she knew it, Lord Renworth having been nothing but flawlessly courteous. All the same, she was suddenly dead certain that on the inside he found her patently ridiculous, perhaps even laughable. Introductions completed, Mr. Drummond began to talk about himself again. Lord Renworth appeared content to let his friend garner all the limelight, and was soon engaged in conversation with Lady Tenwessel, Lady Balfour's daughter, and Louisa's chaperone for the evening. So civil, so gracious, so gentlemanly. Yet Louisa could not shake off the pins-and-needle sensation of his secret, if slight and casual, contempt, as if he viewed her as a toad trying to kiss a prince, and not the sort of toad who was in fact a cursed princess, but just a plain, warty amphibian who didn't know any better. She had no idea it was possible to be this mortified when there was no public humiliation involved, or that it was possible to be this crushed when she ought to be thrilled that she would not, in the end, abandon her fortune-hunting to stalk Lord Renworth all over London. So much for her long-delayed romantic awakening, such a starburst of emotions, and such a lot of nothing. She fluttered her fan, if rather too vigorously, and pretended to listen to Mr. Drummond. Lord Renworth did not speak to her again, and barely looked in her direction. But as the minutes wore on, she grew more and more acutely aware of his observation, of everyone about her and of herself in particular. Had she realized this earlier, she would have been in a state of ferment, turning herself inside out with dizzying conjectures of his possible interest. But now she understood that his scrutiny was wholly clinical. He was not curious at all about her, except perhaps as an exercise to keep his mind sharp. And by this impersonal inspection, he made her feel as if she wore her bust improver on the outside of her bodice for the world to witness, as if he had already seen through her entire facade, from her lack of true beauty to her fundamentally scheming ways. Had she gone mad? It had to be madness on her part to have fabricated this hysterical response to a cordial greeting followed by little else. No one else seemed to share her disquiet. The gentlemen, Mr. Pitt included, were delighted with Lord Renworth in their midst. Lady Tenwessel positively glowed, whereas Louisa felt only unsettled, as if he'd seen her reach into someone's pocket
and she had no choice but to wait to see what he'd do with that incriminating knowledge. Lord Renworth didn't stay long, no more than 10 minutes, given that Mr. Drummond had yet to finish bragging about the chances of one of his horses at the races. When his lordship politely excused himself, saying that he was expected elsewhere, she breathed for what seemed like the first time in years. Mr. Drummond also took to fleeing soon thereafter, upon the arrival of his former mistress, from whom he had severed relations in a most acrimonious manner, according to all reports. Louisa forced herself to rally, to not waste a moment of her precious London time. Even though she made very little headway with Miss Jane Edwards, Lord Firth's sister, who sent her poisonous looks, she danced twice with Lord Firth and sat down to supper with him. She was even more gratified when she at last managed to get Mr. Pitt to speak in detail about the hygrometer that he'd commissioned, based on the latest Italian designs. It was not, however, how others perceived her accomplishments that evening.
"Oh, but I'm excited for you, Louisa," Lady Tenwessel said as soon as the carriage door closed behind them. "To have made Renworth's acquaintance, we should have a toast to that."
His very name tasted acrid.
"That would be premature, wouldn't it, ma'am? Lord Renworth is hardly about to look to me for a wife,"
Louisa said, trying to make sure she sounded pragmatic rather than bitter.
"Besides, he expressed no interest in my person." "Well, I should think less of him if he did, considering who he is and how much he is worth. He would be a fool to go around expressing interest. It would cause a stampede," said Lady Tenwessel. "He spent 10 minutes in your company. That should make Mother quite happy when I tell her."
"But he spent that time in your company, ma'am, not mine."
"Commendable discretion, that. The man has the most beautiful sensitivity to etiquette,"
Lady Tenwessel nodded approvingly.
"It would only make your hand more desirable if it is perceived that Lord Renworth himself might be interested."
The Queen would abandon her widowhood before Lord Renworth proposed to Louisa, for whom he felt nothing but a blasé disdain. Therefore any perception of his interest would serve only to set her cause back. How would poor Mr. Pitt react if he were to be told erroneously that one of the most eligible gentlemen in the land now numbered among her admirers? It was the last thing she wanted. Or was it? She could not deny that as Lady Tenwessel bent Lord Renworth's action to fit her own interpretation, she had felt a tremor of hope. Perhaps she truly had been out of her mind. Perhaps Lady Tenwessel's explanation, however convenient and sanguine, was the correct one. Perhaps, despite his less than kind opinion of her, he did find her appealing in some way.
"Listen to yourself," came the stern voice of her inner taskmaster. "Lady Tenwessel is overly optimistic, and you know it. Do not fictionalise Lord Renworth's sentiments. He has none, none for you in any case. Now concentrate on the achievable."
She stood for a long time before the small window of her room, gazing up at a thoroughly overcast sky, going over her plans and praying for a proposal from Mr. Pitt. But just before she left the window, a single star appeared high overhead, and she was suddenly thinking of Lord Renworth, a flare of incandescence in her heart. Felix stood before the much larger window of his bedroom, examining the same dark clouds, thinking of Miss Cantwell, savouring, almost, this unanticipated interest on his part. 11 years ago such a flicker of curiosity would have alarmed him. But 11 years ago he was still a child, his wounds fresh, and his confidence largely a thing of smoke and mirrors. But now he was the ideal gentleman, admired by men and desired by women, his opinions ardently sought, his style eagerly copied. And it intrigued him that she had turned away from him. Somebody should, but he hadn't expected it of a woman as insignificant as she, hardly the most impressive debutante he'd met in his life, or even in the course of the current season. Granted, she had fine eyes and a good bosom, but the best one could say of her was that she was pleasant. She possessed no remarkable beauty and no particular wit, nor did she emanate that sometimes mysterious power of the fairer sex, the dark, potent allure that struck a man directly in the groin. Over the years he had met a few clever girls who thought they could better intrigue him with a cooler reception. Miss Cantwell was acting too, of course, a young lady of no wealth and no consequence, carrying on as if she had no ulterior motives for being in London. She wasn't so good an actor that he couldn't see through her pretense at 50 paces. She was, however, good enough that he'd been slightly surprised at the transparency of her infatuation. When their gaze had met for the first time, he had almost heard the wedding bells ringing in her ears. Then it dissipated into thin air, not just the look, but the infatuation itself. And that had firmly caught his attention. He enjoyed being the ideal gentleman. He would go on enjoying it for the remainder of his natural life, he was sure. But there were times when he found himself restless and vaguely dissatisfied. Was it really so easy to fool the entire world? Could no one see the cynicism and immorality underneath? And would anyone ever have the audacity to tell him that he was hardly a gentleman, let alone an example to which others should aspire? Miss Cantwell would probably prove to be a mirage, just another young lady who couldn't see an inch beneath his surface. But he would give her a few chances to prove otherwise. Chapter 2
"We must find out to which places he has been invited, my dear, or more usefully, which invitations he has accepted. The man is always drowning in requests for his company, and he is very good about not spreading himself too thin," Lady Balfour said authoritatively, as she and Louisa drove in the park. Louisa fidgeted. It had been 3 days, but the subject of Lord Renworth would not go away. It did not help her resolution to put him behind her once and for all, nor did it help matters on the practical front. A proposal from him was a far-fetched notion that didn't merit any in-depth discussion, let alone motivated efforts. It would be so much more productive if she could convince Lady Balfour to invite Mr. Pitt to one of her dinners. "Wouldn't Lord Renworth prefer to marry a lady with a loftier pedigree or a greater fortune?" Louisa tried one more time. Lady Balfour snorted.
"So he would. But that's what a magnificent catch is all about, gaining the hand of a man who should make a more ruthless choice."
Had her moonier sentiments concerning the ideal gentleman continued unabated, Louisa probably still would have protested, hoping someone would bring her back to her senses. But at the same time she'd have been secretly thrilled that she had her sponsor's backing to go boldly after the man of her dreams. But she no longer wanted to be anywhere near him, a man who made her feel transparently greedy and social climbing.
"Speak of the devil," Lady Balfour whispered urgently.
Lord Renworth emerged from a bend in Rotten Row, the very image of a dashing gentleman charioteer in his nimble caleche. And in spite of Louisa's wariness, her heart skipped a beat. There was no arguing with beauty of such magnitude. "I thought bachelors didn't come for these afternoon drives," she muttered, annoyed with herself.
"So they don't,"
Lady Balfour spoke out of the corner of her mouth, busy nodding at Renworth. After all, he couldn't approach a phaeton driven by ladies unless his presence had first been acknowledged. To Louisa's surprise, he didn't merely nod and move on, but pulled up against their vehicle. "Good afternoon, Lady Balfour. Good afternoon, Miss Cantwell. Enjoying a drive out before the rain comes again?" Try as Louisa did, she could not detect any special inflection in the pronunciation of her name, but as soon as his gaze landed on her, she felt as if she were being peeled like an onion, layer by layer. An experience not the least erotic, but clinical, something done with gloves and forceps.
"But of course. And you, young man, what brought you here?"
Lady Balfour inquired.
"A wild whim,"
he smiled. A man who could smile charmingly at toads, Louisa thought unhappily. He drove abreast of them for no more than a minute. perfectly appropriate, not a hint of impingement on their time. As soon as he left, Lady Balfour began to berate herself for not asking after his itinerary while she had him at her disposal. But even she did not suggest that the meeting was anything other than coincidental. Louisa, however, felt a certain prickling at the base of her spine. Lady Balfour would not have agonized over her missed opportunity had she known that Felix had already bestirred himself to seek them out. He had a good view of Miss Cantwell across a crowded drawing-room at Mrs. Conrad's house. Miss Cantwell pointedly, or so it felt, did not look at all in his direction. He saw her again toward the end of the week, in the midst of a rowing sortie on the river. He wasn't part of their merrymaking party, of course. Rather, he glided by on a yacht with a company of his own. She frolicked and laughed, until she became aware of him. The mirth on her face slipped away, replaced by wariness. So it was no fluke. She truly saw something the matter with him. He was oddly pleased and stumped. What was one to do in such a situation? Certainly he could not walk up to her and say, "Brava, old girl, for having the sense to be wary of me." He put down the book on Asiatic travels he had been browsing. It was nearly 4 o'clock. He'd be expected at his club, his opinions eagerly anticipated on the day's occurrences. As he exited the bookshop located a little way from Piccadilly Circus, however, he almost bumped into the subject of his preoccupation. Miss Cantwell. He ceased flicking book dust from his otherwise immaculate gloves. She had just alighted from a Balfour Victoria, clad in a green velvet walking gown. "I'll be but a second picking up her ladyship's order," she said sweetly to the footman and the driver. She turned around and stilled in shock as she saw him, as if she had the misfortune of finding herself directly in the path of a sharp-fanged wolf. Half a second passed before she recovered her composure. She smiled at him, a smile that radiated no warmth. "My Lord Renworth, how do you do?"
"Very well, thank you. And you, Miss Cantwell?"
He took off his glove and offered his hand. She shook it uncertainly. Then it happened. Her face coloured.
"Very well, too. I'm running some errands for Lady Balfour. Please do not let me keep you."
It dawned on him as she disappeared into the dim interior of the bookshop that she wasn't wholly unaffected by him, as he had assumed. Quite to the contrary. Somewhere deep inside her, the infatuation that he'd thought short-lived still simmered. And at this close range she had been flustered by his presence. It was an entirely new experience for him, to be physically appealing to a woman who otherwise did not care for him. Until this moment, Miss Cantwell had been an intellectual, almost impersonal riddle. Now, for the first time, he became sexually aware of her, and a rather ferocious awareness at that.
"My dear Louisa," cried Lady Balfour, "you will not believe what good fortune has just befallen us."
Louisa, who had a curling iron in her hair, wielded by Lady Balfour's maid, did not dare move.
"Yes, ma'am?" "Tenwhistle was at his club this afternoon, and guess who should come to him full of regret and apologies? Mr. Pitt. He must leave London immediately."
"Oh, no, is everything all right?"
Louisa had been looking forward to sitting next to Mr. Pitt for hours on end. Lady Balfour still thought him too homely, but Lady Tenwhistle was sympathetic to Louisa's cause, and had gone ahead and invited him to dinner, so that Louisa could deepen their acquaintance and, she hoped, hasten the arrival of his proposal.
"Nothing serious. Something to do with the family estate," said Lady Balfour. "That put Tenwhistle in a quandary. With Mr. Pitt's absence, we'd be 13 at the table. So Tenwhistle turned to the gentleman next to him and asked whether he happened to be free this evening."
Such delight, Lady Balfour's reflection in the mirror radiated. An unhappy suspicion began to coalesce in Louisa's head.
"Which gentleman?"
Lady Balfour ignored her question.
The gentleman answered in the affirmative. And he was so amiable as to tell Tenwessel that there was no need for the lady wife at this late hour to rearrange seating to suit a superior rank. He would literally take Mr. Pitt's place at the table.
I see.
Do you, my dear?
Lady Balfour all but twirled.
You are going to sit down to dinner with Lord Renworth. I can't tell you how many mamas have tried to arrange the same for their daughters. To think this should just fall into your lap. You must be the luckiest lady in all of London.
More unnerving words Louisa had seldom heard. Lady Balfour went to fetch her fan, leaving Louisa to stare at her reflection in dismay. Her entire toilette had been oriented toward making herself look as fetching as possible, with an ingenious bust improver that cantilevered her small breasts to the point of spilling over the cusp of her décolletage. And it was too late to change into a different dress, or a less excessive bust improver. The moment Lord Renworth's gaze met hers across Lady Tenwessel's drawing-room, before the ladies and the gentlemen had even been paired for their procession to the dining-table, Louisa already felt the heat of her utter mortification. He knew. He knew that she'd dressed and coiffed herself for Mr. Pitt, the blinding white silk of the dinner-gown, the flirty curls in her hair, and the blasted décolletage that made her chest look like the twin cheeks of a baby's upturned bottom. He knew that she'd meant to appear girlish and pure while leading Mr. Pitt toward resolutely impure thoughts. And he even knew how exasperated she was for all that detailed effort to have gone to waste. All this, and 100 more vexed thoughts, washed through her before he'd even said, "Good evening, Miss Cantwell." What was it about this man that made her lose her mind? And then lose her mind a little more when she had to walk beside him, her hand on his arm. Because he smelled delicious, like that first lungful of fresh air after a good summer shower. Because, though her fingers barely touched his sleeve, she could still feel the shape and strength of his forearm. Because when he leaned toward her and murmured, "You look lovely tonight, Miss Cantwell," she sprouted goosebumps everywhere. "Do you come to London often, Miss Cantwell?" he asked halfway through the first course. She watched as he broke a piece of bread passed around by the servant, his fingers strong and elegant.
"No, sir, I visit quite infrequently."
"And where is home, if I may ask?" He spoke without glancing in her direction, busying himself with his butter knife.
"I live in the Cotswold, not far from Cirencester."
"The Earl of Widenseat is somewhere in the vicinity, is it not?"
"Yes, the estate is about 10 miles away."
When he didn't say anything else, she felt obliged to add, "But we do not know the Earl's family very well." The impoverished relationship